From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what happened at this weekend's Republican and Democratic state conventions?
In the end, it wasn't even close between Nakagiri and Kelly.
The Emerald Ash Borer, its attack on America's trees began in a corner of Wayne County.
This is just getting underway, and it's already the most expensive invasive insect pest that has ever been introduced to North America.
A Michigan poet spends some 40 years translating the powerful words of Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo.
When you take on one of these big projects, you learn things about yourself and about your commitment to the art and what poetry can be.
And we find out how a labor shortage is slowing down new home construction. Those stories and much more today on Stateside for you. Canton Township, Michigan, in Wayne County, ground zero of the Emerald Ash Borer invasion in the USA. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, that beetle is said to be the most destructive bug to ever attack U.S. trees. More than a decade after the discovery, is there anything that can be done to stop the Emerald Ash Borer? Then, home builders in Michigan just don't have enough skilled workers to meet demand. What does it mean for the state's economy if new houses can't be built? That story later this hour. But first, it was a busy political weekend as Michigan Democrats and Republicans held their respective conventions. There were things that happened as predicted, a few surprises, and some serious jabs. Chris Gouts, Lansing reporter for Crane's Detroit Business, is here. Hi, Chris.
Hello there.
And we welcome back Chad Livengood, who covers Lansing for the Detroit News. Hey, Chad.
Thanks for having me, as always.
First, Chad, to the GOP. Of course, predictions were all out there that Tea Party favorite Wes Nakagiri was not going to succeed in his bid to boot Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly off the ticket. And, predictions were 100% correct. I'm wondering, what was the mood between the establishment Republicans and the Tea Party afterwards?
Some of the Tea Party folks who were supporting Wes Nakagiri were understandably upset that they didn't prevail. There was definitely some relishing among some of the establishment-type Republicans who have taken a little bit of a beating in past conventions and had some of their own folks lose or come near a loss. I mean, just last year, Bobby Shostak, the Republican Party chairman, only won re-election by a handful of votes, and it put a scare into some people in the establishment, to say the least. Ron Weiser, the former party chairman, lost a bid to be nominated for the U of M Board of Regents 2 years ago and came back and did it again this year and just pulled off a win, a second place, I guess you might say, in the nomination for two open seats. But it was pretty close, and he had to work pretty hard to get it. So, the establishment is happy today.
There was a little bit of booyah, huh, when that happened. What stuck out in your mind, Chris?
Well, I think, like Chad said, in the end, it wasn't even close between Nakagiri and Kelly. While it was expected, it wasn't entirely clear because all of those that were saying that Kelly was likely to prevail had a vested interest in saying that, because by trying to really prop up that he had it in the bag, it had the effect of possibly discouraging, Nakagiri supporters from making the trip to Novi and spending all day inside on a very nice day outside like we all did. but in the end, it just really wasn't. It ended up not being close. So it really was the establishment victory that I think a lot of people saw, and it worked. It proved that the money spent and the time that it took really doing this unique once in a probably lifetime effort of getting all of these delegates and precinct delegates and going through that whole process of the county conventions really translated into a success on Saturday.
Well, and here we have Wes Nakagiri today saying he hasn't decided whether or not he will vote for Rick Snyder in November. So how much of a problem do you think this type of talk could be for the Snyder-Kelly ticket, Chad?
Well, any voter is free to not fill in one of the races, and they could just go, skip the governor's race. How much that really, transcends to the ballot and hurts the governor, so it's kind of unclear. It depends on just sort of you know, if folks are really upset, they're, you know, and they're going to sit it out in protest, and then they're going to risk getting Mark Schauer in the governor's office. If that's what they want, then that's fine for them. But so that's going to be kind of the rationality. There's going to be an argument made by within the conservative movement that that we've got to just put this guy in because he's as close to what we are than Mark Schauer is.
Which takes us right over to the Democrats, and there was absolutely no question that Mark Schauer and Lisa Brown were going to head the ticket. Chad, what do you think the big story was out of the Democratic convention?
Well, they avoided a little bit of an inter-party squabble themselves over the nomination of a Supreme Court justice candidate, Judge William Murphy, as chief judge of the Michigan Court of Appeals. In the past, Judge Murphy has been endorsed by Right to Life of Michigan, and so you don't get Right to Life's endorsement unless you have essentially espoused some anti-abortion rights viewpoint at some point. So even though he was pretty coy about what exactly his personal views are, the Women and Justice Caucuses of the Democratic Party kind of protested his nomination, and then they ended up actually forcing a renomination or a second vote on Sunday, even though he'd already been nominated on Saturday. They kind of tried to hash that out Saturday evening so it wouldn't be an issue on the big day when they were trying to put on a united front. So that was kind of the most firecrackers that went off, I guess you might say, at the Democratic convention. But this strategy issue of the turnout game, you're going to see this ramped up a lot more in the next couple weeks as we get closer to when the absentee ballots go out in early October, because the real key here is to try to get people to vote early and get them to make the decision now and to get larger numbers of absentee ballots returned as fast as possible.
I want to get your thoughts from both of you about a candidate who won the GOP nomination to run for State Board of Education. Her name is Maria Carle from Macomb County. Maybe remembered by some for her outburst at a GOP state convention in 1992. I'll just recap for everybody. It happened when Andrea Fisher became a candidate for a seat on the Republican National Committee, and Maria Carle shouted out, "She's a Jew, she's a Jew," and called on Macomb delegates to vote instead for Betsy DeVos because, quote, "she isn't a Jew." So that was in 1992. Did that episode figure at all, and did it come up at all as she was nominated on Saturday, Chris?
Yeah, it did. Leon Gillette, a former lawmaker, was passing out flyers to the press and was talking with delegates and trying to make the case. But she did come out on top, and she did win a spot. And so there were some in the party that were very concerned about that. One, just because they don't want somebody that has those views, or at least supposedly had those views then, representing them. But also they know that Democrats are absolutely going to use that, that the Republican Party nominated an anti-Semite, using their words, I'm not calling her, but that's clearly going to be used against her. And they'll be able to use that against other candidates and say, "Do you endorse, do you support this anti-Semite?" It can become an issue in a whole bunch of other races. And so they've really given themselves a headache that they probably were hoping that they could have avoided.
Well, and to make things worse for Ms. Carle, she was approached by reporters at the end of the Republican press conference after the convention, and initially it looked like she was staying over the stage over as the reporters were on the floor, and they were trying to get her to answer some questions, and she was looking at some of the GOP staff and some of the other candidates as they were exiting the room, and decided to sort of make a bolt for the door herself. So she did not take any time to talk to anybody or address this. So it'll start with her trying to essentially address these 22-year-old comments. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, like Chris said, every candidate probably from the top of the ticket down is going to have to answer questions about Ms. Carle's comments. And the Democrats have firepower from a Republican activist in Leon Drillet, who essentially used this same issue against her when he ran for the state house in 2004 in Macomb County.
Chris Gouts, you tweeted out a photo Saturday of some bumper stickers available at the GOP convention. I have that in front of me here. I will read these three bumper stickers. One says, KFC Hillary special, too fat thighs, too small breast, left wing. Another says, Hillary, there's a village in Arkansas missing their idiot.
Well, one, that the grammar's not correct. It should be missing its idiot, not their idiot.
Very good.
But that aside, I think it was just something. There were obviously vendors there that were selling things. I don't think it's indicative of the feelings of party. It was hard to tell. I didn't see anybody, people buying them in mass. But it's clearly a sentiment that's there. And obviously it's expressed enough that a vendor thought that there was a market for that at the convention. And it maybe could have been something that the staff, you know, if they would have gone around and said, maybe we don't want to have that here. Maybe that's not a good idea.
Did we see any similar examples of kind of this Mr. Nasty streak at the Democratic convention? Was there any low blows thrown there?
I mean, there was definitely comments made about various candidates, opposing candidates, but we didn't see any bumper stickers like this emerge. Surely there was probably a similar village idiot type bumper sticker made about George W. Bush in the state of Texas. The Democrats have probably peddled at some point as well. So this is not uncommon, but obviously these definitely cross the line into sexism.
Yeah, and I think while you didn't see maybe bumper stickers, you know, House Minority Leader Tim Grimmel did make some comments. You know, I think he was trying to use alliteration and maybe didn't pick his words the best. And there have been some conservatives and Republicans that are pointing out at the convention, he called the Republicans, quote, a party of bigots, billionaires, and bullies. I mean, he's taken some grief for that. And obviously at conventions, you're trying to rile up your base, and you're going to say things that when a general audience looks at them, you think, man, maybe that wasn't the best choice of words. And so that, again, is something that both sides are going to look at and will use to their advantage.
Chris Gouts from Crane's Detroit Business Chat, live and good of the Detroit News. Always a pleasure talking with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We live, it's safe to say, in an era of instant gratification. Whatever it is, we want fast results. We want it done now. But there are those who are willing to take whatever time it takes to accomplish something they believe is worth doing and doing right. My next guest is one such person. Clayton Eshelman is a professor emeritus in the English department at Eastern Michigan University. He's a poet. He's a translator. Clayton Eshelman spent decades translating the works of renowned Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo. It has become a book that's entitled The Complete Poetry, Cesar Vallejo, a translation that's earned him awards. So, Clayton Eshelman, very good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
How many years did it take? I'm holding this hefty 676-page translation of Vallejo's poetry.
Well, I discovered Vallejo when I was a student at Indiana University and had just started writing poetry in 1957. I discovered Vallejo and Pablo Neruda in an anthology, and that moved me to hitchhike 2 summers to go to Mexico and start to learn Spanish. And then I moved to Japan for several years and took a collection of Vallejo's poems with me to Japan with me. And once there, I began to try to figure out what I was going to do with my life as a poet. I mean, it's one thing to write poems when you're in college. It's something else when you get out.
And there are bills to pay.
And I was teaching English as a second language to Japanese executives at the time. So I had a friend named Will Peterson, and he came over to visit me one day, and I said, where have you been? He said, I just met a very interesting man. He says, he's a bonsai gardener. He says, he just finished his apprenticeship. And I said, well, how old is he? And he says, well, he's in his early 60s. And that really took me, because I'd never thought about apprenticeship before. And here I was facing the fact that in another society, why, you apprentice yourself most of your life to the art or the discipline, and then had a chance after that to do something on your own. So I started thinking about apprenticeship, and I took out the Vallejo poetry one day and started reading it. It was very complex and beyond my Spanish at the time. At one point, I read a poem of Vallejo's from the Human Poems, which was written in Paris in the 1930s. And I read a poem that just made my hair stand on end. And I'm thinking maybe it would be appropriate to read that poem now, because it was the piece that really got me involved in Vallejo.
All right, go ahead.
It's untitled. There are days there comes to me an exuberant political hunger to desire, to kiss tenderness on both cheeks. And there comes to me from afar a demonstrative desire, another desire to love, willingly or by force, whoever hates me, whoever tears up his paper, the little boy, the woman who weeps for the man who was weeping, the king of wine, the slave of water, whoever hid in his wrath, whoever sweats, whoever passes by, whoever shakes his person in my soul. And I desire, therefore, to adjust the braid of whoever talks to me, the soldier's hair, the light of the great, the greatness of the child. I desire to iron directly a handkerchief for whoever is unable to cry, and when I'm sad or happiness aches me, to mend the children and the geniuses. I desire to help the good one become a little bad, and I have an urge to be seated to the right of the left-handed and to respond to the mute, trying to be useful to him as I can. And likewise, I desire very much to wash the cripple's foot and to help my one-eyed neighbor sleep. Ah, to desire, this one, mine, this one, the world's, interhuman and parochial, mature. It comes perfectly timed from the foundation, from the public groin, and coming from afar makes me hunger to kiss the singer's muffler, and whoever suffers, to kiss him on his frying pan, the deaf man fearlessly on his cranial murmur, whoever gives me what I forgot in my breast, on his Dante, on his chaplain, on his shoulders. I desire, finally, when I'm at the celebrated edge of violence or my heart full of chest, I would desire to help whoever smiles laugh, to put a little bird right on the evildoer's nape, to take care of the sick, annoying them, to buy from the vendor, to help the killer kill. A terrible thing. And I would desire to be good to myself in everything.
That is Clayton Eshelman, who spent how many years, Clayton? That poem launched you into...
Yes, it ended in 2007 when University of California Press published The Complete Poetry. But there were many stages in the in the production.
But an overall, you spent literally some 45 years working on this translation of The Complete Poetry.
From time to time.
Yes. not nonstop, but
not nonstop,
working to bring the poems of Cesar Vallejo to audiences in America.
Right.
First of all, tell us who this man was.
Well, he was a Peruvian born in a small mountain village called Santiago de Chuco in northern Peru, parallel to Trujillo.
And in the late 19th
in
century.
In 1892. Mm. And he studied philosophy at the University of Trujillo and moved to Lima. He got involved in a situation where a store was burned and someone was murdered in his hometown. And he was associated with the evildoers, and so he spent 3 months in jail at one point. And while he was in jail, he began to work on the poems that ultimately became Trilce, which is his second collection, published in 1923, and which is one of the strangest and most groundbreaking books of poetry published this century. Mm. After he got out of jail, he found out that he was going to be indicted and he might go to prison. So he accepted a third-class boat ticket to Europe and moved to France and never returned to Peru. He lived until 1938, mainly in Paris. He was extremely poor, homeless at times. he met a woman who had a little money, and she meagerly supported him for a while. At one point, he made a trip to Russia, and he wrote a couple of travel books on Russia. He became a communist in 1928. He spent time in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, and his last collection, the fourth collection of poems, is called España, parte de mí es de Cáliz, Spain, take this cup from me, in which he takes the words of Christ to the Father and places Mother Spain in the place of the Father. He returned to Paris and died from no particular explanation.
But a terribly hard life.
Yeah.
In 1938, he died.
Yeah. So he was 46 years old.
What do you think that this man, born in the Peruvian Andes over 120 years ago, says to readers in Michigan in 2014?
I think the key lesson that he holds today may be that a poet must learn how to become imprisoned in global life as a whole and in each moment in particular, to believe that his bewildering situation and his destiny are significant, and to try to, as it were, engage not only the personal life, but a political life as it infects him. In other words, it's an attempt to deal as thoroughly as possible with the contradictions and the irresolutions in the world, and to stay with it, and to believe that your bewildering situation is significant.
When you were inspired by that poem that you just read to us of Vallejo's, did you realize you were embarking on something that would be more than four decades long to be able to translate these poems? You were even saying it was beyond your Spanish. So you had to teach yourself more Spanish?
I had to teach myself more Spanish. And I also, at various stages in this saga, I worked with scholars because my Spanish has never become good enough to completely on my own deal with someone as complex as Vallejo. Mm. At the beginning, I was working on his finest collection of poems called the Poemas Humanos, the human poems, which were written in Europe. And my first sense was that I would take on my apprenticeship by translating the 89 poems in the human poems. So I did 9 drafts, and Grove Press brought out a translation of the human poems in 1968. I moved to Los Angeles. I was part of the faculty of the California College of the Arts in 1970. And I met a man named Jose Rubio Barcia, who was a poet and a translator and a scholar who was at UCLA. And at that point, I had not done the Spanish poems, and so I asked Barcia if he would like to go over the Spanish texts with me. We worked together so well that I tremblingly showed him my human poems translation and ask him what he thought of it. And he said, well, it's not bad. He said, but it can be much better. So almost every evening after dinner for the next 5 years, I went over to Barcia's house and we worked several hours on going over my translation of the human poems. So University of California Press then brought out that collection called The Complete Posthumous Poetry in 1978, and it received the National Book Award.
Yes, it did.
I thought my work was over at that point, but then I began to nag myself over Trilce, because Trilce was the real mountain with Vallejo. So to make the long saga a bit shorter, I worked on Trilce in the late 80s, and one version was published in 1989. A second version was published in the early 1990s by Wesleyan University Press, and then a third version was published when I brought out the complete poetry in 2007.
And here it is. Yeah. What surprised you about yourself and about Vallejo as you took such a deep, deep dive as you translated his works?
I was surprised that I had the stamina to do this. I went to Peru in 1965. At that point, I had a seventh draft, and I went to Peru because his widow, Georgette, a French woman who he married in the early 30s, was living, thanks to the Peruvian government, quite well in Lima, Peru. And she had the worksheets for the human poems, which had never been completed in Vallejo's life. He died before he could complete the book, and he left a typed manuscript with many penciled corrections on it. She read the penciled corrections and created a text and a book. And then she began to quarrel with everyone, and various versions of the human poems started coming out, all with many errors, because she would not allow anyone to have contact with the worksheets. She had a terrible hate and love relationship with him. So I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get to the bottom of this thing is if I go to Lima and get her to show me the worksheets so I can work off of the worksheets rather than these erroneous texts.
And by this point, you had some credibility.
Well, I also had a pregnant wife and $300, and off we went. And I got down to Lima, and once I made contact with her, why, she told me that the worksheets were not available, and she didn't really want to have anything to do with my work. So there I was, sort of stuck in Lima with a pregnant wife and not knowing what to do with myself.
By the way, we should say your wife's an angel.
So I found someone to work with in Lima, a woman named Maureen Ahern, who was a scholar of Peruvian literature, came back, and after I got back, I moved to New York, and I completed a ninth draft. At that point, the problem was to get Georgette's permission, because Grove Press was convinced that if they published my translation without her permission, she could sue them. So that's another story which I go into in the translation memoir. But somehow we tricked her into signing a contract. And so that's how the first human poems came out in 1968.
Tell me what lessons you believe that we could all learn, not even so much from the actual poems of Vallejo, but your undertaking and your diligence and your stick-to-itiveness over these decades.
Well, I think it's very important for artists to take on big saturation jobs, one or two at least, in their lifetime. I think you learn something from a big, long project in which you try to corner or to encompass everything about one particular subject. When you take on one of these big projects that are really involve a terrific saturation, you learn things about yourself and about your commitment to the art and what poetry can be that you don't by simply working on single individual poems.
Would you close by sharing another favorite poem of Vallejo's with us,
please? Yeah. This is another one from the Human Poems. Though maybe since I read one from the Human Poems, I should read one from Trilce. To give the listeners a sense of a different aspect of Vallejo. This is Trilce number 36. There are 77 poems in Trilce, and they're just numbered. Many are not titled. This was published before he left Peru in 1923. We struggle to thread ourselves through a needle's eye, face to face, hell-bent on winning. The fourth angle of the circle ammoniifies, almost. Female is continued the male on the basis of probable breasts and precisely on the basis of how much does not flower. Are you that way, Venus de Milo? You hardly act crippled, pullulating and wombed in the plenary arms of existence, of this existence that nevertheless is perpetual imperfection. Venus de Milo, whose cut-off increate arm swings round and tries to elbow across greening, stuttering pebbles, ortive nautili, recently crawling evens, immortal on the eaves of. Lassoer of eminences, lassoer of the parenthesis. Refuse, all of you, to set foot on the double security of harmony. Truly refuse symmetry. Intervene in the conflict of points that contend in the most rutty of jousts for the leap through the needle's eye. So now I feel my little finger in excess on my left. I see it and think, it shouldn't be me, or at least that it's in a place where it shouldn't be. And it inspires me with rage and alarms me, and there is no way out of it except by imagining that today is Thursday. Make way for the new odd number, potent with orphanhood.
That is the poetry of Cesar Vallejo, considered to be one of the greatest poets of the 20th century in any language, being read by Clayton Eshelman, my guest, who's editor and translator of the complete poetry, Cesar Vallejo. He's also professor emeritus of English at Eastern Michigan University. Professor, thank you so much for sharing your love of poetry with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Home builders in Michigan are having a tough time finding enough workers to meet demand. Bob Filka is CEO of the Home Builders Association of Michigan. Bob, usually some 28,000 new homes are built every year in Michigan. And this past year, just 13,000. Why is that?
Well, actually, and that number is actually about 38% more than occurred in 2012. So actually, the percentages are going up pretty dramatically. But since we fell so low during the downturn, it's going to take us a while to get back up to that level. And obviously, as you mentioned, workforce issues are one of the reasons why we're not going to be able to produce that many homes for a number of years.
So what kind of workforce issues are we talking about? What kind of jobs are going begging?
Well, everything from framers to carpenters to plumbers and electricians. It really runs the gamut. And it stems from the fact that during the downturn, we actually, some of the statistics that the Labor Department has kept, I mean, we lost approximately 60,000 workers in the industry during the downturn. So they left the state, they found a different career, they retired. Many of those individuals are not coming back to the jobs in the sector. At the same time, we've had kind of a college track mentality in school over the last several years, and many of the programs, the voc ed programs and other things that kids coming through school used to enroll in got, you know, mothballed or less focus and attention on those. So we kind of had a perfect storm of people leaving the industry, very few potential workers kind of taking the training and education they need to get into the industry. And now, over the next several years, as you mentioned, we're kind of forecasting significant shortages. And so as a result, it's going to put pressure on how long it takes to get a new home built, how long it takes to get someone to come out and check your house if you have a problem with plumbing or your electrical systems.
And it's really quite stunning. I actually know from personal experience how folks like heating and cooling, the HVAC folks and painters were calling around going, if anybody has any work, please. They were just beating the bushes for work during the worst of the recession, and now they probably have more than they can handle.
They do. It's a good problem to have based on where the industry was. So it's a good sign that home values are rising, that there's more people interested in seeing improvements in their homes because they're seeing that equity in their homes rise. All those things are all good things, but we kind of lose sight of the fact that, well, gee, now what? We're going, you know, in fact, some economists and some markets are suggesting that, you know, we could have a whole new housing bubble be created because of a lack of production, that there's just not the people and the manpower to meet that demand over the next few years. You know, whether that occurs in Michigan, I kind of question that at this point, but I do think it's possible looking at the numbers.
Also, Bob, what about finance issues for the builders? Is that playing into this construction slowdown?
It does, simply because there still aren't very many lenders out there who are providing loans for development. You know, spec homes, or we call them inventory homes. So there are very few. In the past, under normal market conditions, you know, banks would loan money to builders to develop an area, build several dozen homes, knowing that those homes would be in demand. That kind of development lending obviously went by the wayside during the downturn. There are some equity investors and others who have put money into that kind of development, but it really, you know, pales in comparison in terms of the leverage that used to be there from private lenders who would lend money to builders across the state. That money's not there today, generally speaking, so there are fewer homes being built unless builders have a buyer lined up. They're typically not building unless they're one of the larger volume builders in the state. You know, companies like Eastbrook and Mayberry and Allen Edwin, obviously Pulte Homes, those types of builders are building more inventory homes. but not at the scale that they used to. And so obviously also the smaller, medium-sized builders, they don't have the capital to do that kind of inventory building. So as a result, you know, you have many communities, you know, particularly where there's new job creation, you have people moving into an area, there may not be any newly constructed homes for them to look at. So that is a challenge for some communities who are worried about kind of capturing new workers as new jobs are being created. Community developers really need to be looking at this issue as an economic development issue for their area of the state.
So there's that challenge. And also, what does all of this tell us about job possibilities for young people considering the building trades, and at the same time, what the schools should be looking at?
Well, fortunately, the governor did sign into a law a change in our curriculum requirements for high school graduation that will provide some greater flexibility for kids to enroll in these voc ed programs and still qualify and meet all the graduation requirements. But I think culturally, one of the things we're looking at partnering up with other construction associations, so commercial construction, other types of organizations who represent pieces of the construction sector, to see if we can really try to get a campaign going, because it's really a cultural awareness type of issue, and to make it clear that, you know, these types of jobs are available and someone can make a pretty good living and career with a modest amount of training and hard work. These are great paying jobs, and, you know, and unfortunately I think there's a perception that these are all dirty jobs, that, you know, they're not the jobs that I want my child to go into. Really, they're very fulfilling jobs and very rewarding and good jobs, and they're not all what some might consider to be dirty jobs. There are plenty of very technical and design-oriented types of tasks that are needed for residential building. And so culturally, I think we need to change the mindset, and that's just going to take time.
Bob Filka is CEO of the Home Builders Association of Michigan. Bob, thanks for talking with us on Stateside today.
Thanks, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
The emerald ash borer is said to be the most destructive, most costly bug that's ever attacked trees in North America. And Dan Herms is on a mission to stop them. Dan is a professor of entomology at Ohio State University. Dan, when and where did the emerald ash borer first arrive in North America?
The evidence is pretty solid, based on research done at Michigan State University by Deb McCullough and her colleagues, that it first established in Canton Township between Detroit and Ann Arbor, and it has spread from there to, I think, 24 states now, as you mentioned, all the way out to Colorado.
How do we think it arrived?
Nobody knows that for sure, but it almost certainly arrived via infested wood that's used in international commerce, like pallets, solid wood packing, something like that, that was constructed out of infested ash trees in Asia. And so they hitchhike in commerce and establish in their new home.
Tell us about this bug. How does it kill, and what kind of impact has it had?
Emerald ash borer is especially devastating because it feeds on the vascular tissue of the tree, which is the tissue that moves water and nutrients from the roots to the leaves and from the leaves to the roots. And so that tree is very vulnerable to that kind of damage. And these insects just overwhelm the tree, destroy that tissue, and the tree dies very quickly after it starts showing symptoms of infestation.
And has it had the same effect in China where this bug originated?
So the trees that are native to China are highly resistant to EAB. And so it's not a huge problem in China. There it behaves more like our native wood borers here do, where they attack the sick and the weak and kill the stress trees. However, in an interesting observation, North American ash trees had been widely planted in China. And it turns out, looking back at reports, that emerald ash borer just devastated those North American trees that were planted in China, and that could have been a red flag had, you know, we've been paying attention.
And how long did it take from the time this emerald ash borer arrived in the United States, apparently in Canton, Michigan, how long did it take for us to start paying attention?
Well, it was discovered in 2002. Deb McCullough and Nate Siegert's study suggests that it was established at least 10 years prior to that. And indeed, we found some trees in Kensington Metro Park, not too far from there, that were killed as early as 1994 using the same tree ring reconstruction. you know, most invasive species are present for a while at low levels before their population kind of explodes and they become noticed. But this was noticed in 2001. You know, there were reports in the Detroit Free Press and other outlets describing this mysterious malady of ash trees. And my father-in-law lives in Detroit. He had been sending me those articles, but it wasn't determined what the causal agent was until 2002.
And here we have it. The culprit is the emerald ash borer. Any idea how many trees, Dan, this thing's killed?
No, no idea. The last statistical estimate was done in, I think, 2007, estimated 50 million dead ash trees, and now it's spread to 24 states. The number of dead trees has increased exponentially, and it's, as you mentioned in your introduction, untold millions.
Mm-mm. I'm talking with entomology professor Dan Herms from Ohio State University, who, along with Michigan State University professor of entomology and forestry Deb McCullough, has co-authored a piece about the emerald ash borer. And in that article, Dan, you guys write that emerald ash borers are the most costly biological invasion by an exotic forest insect to date. That's pretty heavy duty. How costly?
Well, it's cost, you know, tens of millions of dollars. That was a study done by Deb McCullough and her colleagues, including economists. And I don't actually know the exact numbers. I've seen another study that shows that in Ohio, it's estimated that it will ultimately cost between $4 and $7 billion once it's all said and done. And this is primarily due to the death and replacement of ash trees in urban environments where they have to be removed because they're hazard trees after they die. But there's also economic impacts on the nursery industry, on the forest products and timber industry, and so it's wide-ranging. The economic impact is very wide-ranging. And it's just getting started because if you look at it, this is a continental-scale problem. It's going to continue to spread. And while it's already in 24 states, most of those states still have very low populations. They're not experiencing yet the kind of impact that Michigan is, that Ohio, that Indiana, and Illinois, kind of at that core area. So this is just really is still just getting underway, and it's already the most expensive invasive insect pest that has ever been introduced to North America.
Well, Dan, what can science offer in terms of either ways to save remaining ash trees and make them more resistant, or in somehow engineering this emerald ash borer in such a way that it can't hurt the trees?
Well, that's an interesting question. We're conducting research with colleagues with the USDA Forest Service to try to develop resistant trees through breeding. And as I mentioned before, we found that it's not a pest in Asia, and to a large degree, that's because the Asian trees are naturally resistant. And so we're working to understand why the Asian trees are resistant, what the underlying genes are, and to see if they can be hybridized with North American trees and bred, much in the same way that they have successfully done with chestnut and chestnut blight and Dutch elm disease and American elms, where you hybridize with resistant species, back cross, and get a tree that's largely North American genome, but with the resistance genes from Asia. The other approach is we're trying to find trees that have survived where EAB has killed 99 or more than 99% of the trees, as is the case in Southeast Michigan, and then determine if those trees are naturally resistant or if they're just lucky. And if they're naturally resistant, they can be used as a source of germplasm for breeding native trees, which would be ideal. Another approach that's being taken to try to slow the spread is the use of biological control. You know, a balance of nature exists in areas where an insect has evolved, in this case, China for EAB. And the USDA has searched for natural enemies, specifically parasitic wasps, tiny little wasps that are harmless to humans. They don't sting, but they lay their eggs on emerald ash borer or in emerald ash borer eggs and provide a natural control. And so those have been released in North America with the hope that they could build up to high enough populations to slow the spread. That hasn't happened yet, but that might be something that works out more in the future. As far as targeting the insect itself, research is underway to determine how the insect is able to colonize ash, which has natural defenses, and overcome those defenses so effectively. And they can detoxify these defensive compounds, once those mechanisms are understood, they can be targeted through novel molecular biology techniques. For example, you can silence RNA in the insect that would then eliminate the gene expression that produces those enzymes that detoxify the defense.
Now, yeah, there we go. We're talking really, really, you know, high-tech kind of science engineering.
Right. And so that's obviously, you know, down the road. But that those are the kind of research projects that are underway.
As science searches for a way to beat back the emerald ash borer, what can individuals do to either help preserve ash trees and to especially stop the spread of the ash borer? Is this really something that authorities and governmental bodies have to handle?
The answer is yes to both. Individuals can do things and regulatory agencies. So regulatory agencies are trying to slow the spread by preventing artificial spread of emerald ash borer. Emerald ash borer is going to continue to spread on its own. But the reason that it's gotten to Colorado and to Georgia from Canton Township in just 12 years is not because it's flown there on its own. It's because it's been moved by humans through things like infested firewood. And so people can prevent that artificial long-distance rapid movement by not moving firewood, for example. Don't take firewood out of the local environment when you go camping. Buy the local firewood and burn it there. Now, if people have individual trees that they highly value, that they want to protect, that can be done very effectively with systemic insecticides. So you can treat an ash tree with a systemic insecticide and protect it, even under intense pest pressure, we've shown in our research, and even really big trees. We've shown that you can protect trees that we're working with are up to 50 inches in diameter, which is about as big an ash tree as you're going to find in a, you know, a residential area. And so, you know, it's a little pricey, perhaps, depending on the size of the tree. Larger trees, obviously, more expensive, but they can be protected quite effectively. And a number of people and municipalities are choosing to protect these trees because it's cost effective. The cost of treating the trees is less than the economic value that those trees provide.
Quite mind-boggling to think of the effect of a half-an-inch bug named the emerald ash borer. Dan Herms, professor of entomology at Ohio State University. Really insightful. You gave us a lot to think about, and we'll certainly watch that firewood with a very, very close eye. Dan, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was directed today by Allie Billings, and our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Michelle Hahn. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.